Good evening. It's good to be with the grown-ups for a change. Yeah, I brought the youth group with me, though, and they're hanging out, which is really cool. Yeah. And I'm glad that Balance and Ian and Tom and them could all do worship for you guys tonight. We're very blessed by them. But tonight, I'm actually not going to be doing a Bible study, really. I'm actually going to be talking about secularism or postmodernism. So we're actually not going to be in the Bible a whole lot. I actually have a long list of really depressing atheistic quotes for you guys. So this is a great night to be here. And let's pray and we'll get started. Dear God, I want to thank you so much that we have this opportunity to really take a look at your gospel, Lord, and to really see how it stands up in our culture today. I pray that you would help us to see you in a new light tonight, God, to love you more and to draw closer to you. And in your name, amen. So the first thing I want to mention is kind of like what do I mean when I say secularism? I don't mean specifically atheism, the belief that there is no God. Well, what I mean is it's either a belief that there is no God or a belief that the God that we know is not one that could be talked about inside of any book. So you guys may have heard it said somewhat like this, of like, well, I believe in a God or a force out there who created everything. But I just don't think that he is so tiny and petty as the pages of the Bible or the Quran or the Torah or anything like that. He's got to be greater than that, and he's more multifaceted than that. And so I believe in this complex being who's out there, and that's who I believe in, and that's kind of just what I believe about my life. I don't really believe in absolute truth. You guys may have heard it someone like that, and that's actually the way, the direction that our culture is going. Whether or not you are, like I said, an outspoken atheist, or you could actually be someone who goes to church on a pretty regular basis and have this kind of belief system behind you. Because if you go to church and you have this belief system behind you, all you're saying is like, well, I like the community and I like Christian people, but it doesn't mean that I have to necessarily believe in their dogmatic view of God. I could just, you know, I believe that there is a God and I like their songs and stuff like that, so I enjoy coming. And the question that we could ask is, why is our culture going this way? What appeal does this belief system have? And I could talk a little more frankly about this. I grew up in the church, and at the age of 13, I became an atheist. And one of my major motivations for becoming an atheist was I was a 13-year-old boy, and I found pornography, and I realized that I didn't like the biblical view of sex. I didn't like what God said about my sexuality. I was tired of feeling guilty all the time about sinning. And so I decided it would be easier for me to just not believe in any God. And I'm not the only one who feels this way. This is a quote from Albert Camus. He wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus. He's a philosopher. And this is what he said. We modern people believe in absolute freedom. Many of us don't believe in God at all. Many of us don't believe in a God that you can actually know. Therefore, we believe in no God, or no God you could really know, because we believe in freedom. If there was a God we could know, who told us how to live, and who gave us the rules and the regulations, well, then we wouldn't be free, because we believe in freedom, and because we don't believe in the traditional view of God, we are free. And actually, there was a movie that came out not too long ago that had a very similar idea to Albert Camus. It's a modern classic called I, Robot with Will Smith. I don't know if you guys saw it. It came out like 10 years ago. It was decent. And in the movie, I don't want to give any spoilers in case any of you guys want to rent it tonight. But in the movie, there is a character in the movie who, guess what? It's a robot. And he was created and designed for a specific purpose. And at the end of the movie, he's talking to Will Smith's character, and he's fulfilled his purpose. And he says, well, what do I do now? And Will Smith looks at him and he says, well, now you have to figure out your own meaning of existence, just like the rest of us. I guess that's what it means to be free. You guys understand that? So here's what he's saying. If you have a creator who told you how to live, you're not free to do whatever you want to do. You must conform to those particular regulations. And if you do that, you're no better than a robot or a slave. And so we believe in freedom, this is what Albert Camus says, because we believe in freedom, we reject the traditional view of God. That's what modern people think. Now, many atheists may not say it that way, or secular people may not say it that way. They'll try to present it in such a way where it's like it's more of a progressive way of thinking, and we're trying to be more inclusive, and we're trying to be more understanding, and we're trying not to be so hard-headed or simple-minded, and that's why we're moving in this direction. And don't get me wrong, there are many reasons to become a secularist or an atheist. There are many reasons to go this direction. But for me, and I believe a lot of other people, this reason of desiring freedom is one of the major underlying reasons. And this becomes a problem. If you believe this way, and you believe that believing in God means that you have to give up your freedom, you cannot become objective about the facts of whether or not Jesus Christ really did die on a cross and rise again. You can't be objective because you've already made up your mind of what you want to believe. This is what Aldous Huxley says, and he, once again, this is an atheist, this is not a Christian, but this is what he says. He's very honest. He says this in his book, Ends and Means. He says, I had motives for wanting the world to have meaning, to not have a meaning, and consequently assumed that it had none, and was able, without any large difficulty, to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. Now listen to this. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he, personally, should not do as he wants to do. For myself, and as no doubt for most of my friends, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of sexual morality. Now, he's being very honest there. You see what he's saying? He's saying these modern people, you know, are young people, they're going to college, and they're learning all these different philosophies and worldviews, and they think they're being objective, but they're not. They're not. You're not being objective. I wasn't being objective. I wanted there to not be a meaning, because then I could do what I wanted. And surprise ending, I figured out that there was no meaning to life. You see? If I already have my mind made up, of course I'm going to come to the conclusion I want to come to. And so this is what this talk is meant to do. It's not meant to prove anything. But here's what it's meant to do. It's meant to show a couple things. Number one, no one could actually live this way. No one can actually live knowing this information and taking it to its logical conclusion. No one can actually live this way and be a functioning human being. And the other thing that I want to show tonight is that the gospel is far more liberating than you may think. Let's begin with that first point. There are repercussions. Yes, this philosophy does lead to a certain level of freedom, but there are repercussions for thinking this way. And the number one repercussion of thinking this way, the number one consequence of believing this, is you must come to the conclusion that there is no ultimate meaning for existence. You must come to the conclusion that there is no ultimate meaning for existence. Now, I'm not saying that you can't live for anything if you believe this way. Obviously, the whole point that you believe this way is you want to construct your own reason for living. What I'm saying is that no matter what reason you construct for yourself, it's not an ultimate one, and it will die with you. This is what Leo Tolstoy said, very famous author, wrote War and Peace. He wrote later on in his life about his own depression. And this is what he said. This is not a fable, but the literal, incontestable truth which everyone must understand. Now this is what he says. What will be the outcome of what I do today? Of what I shall do tomorrow? What will be the outcome of all my life? Why should I live? Why should I do anything? Or to put it another way, is there in life any purpose which the inevitable death that awaits me does not undo and destroy? See what he's saying? No matter what meaning that you come up with, whether you say, I want to live for my career, or I want to live for fame, or I want to live for money, or I want to live for sex, no matter what meaning you construct for yourself, one day you're going to die. And when you die, whatever meaning you constructed for yourself, whether it is selfish, or whether it's noble, whether you say, I want to live to better the human race, one day you're going to die, and everything you've done will be forgotten. Tolstoy is going to be forgotten. He understood that. He's going to be forgotten much longer in the future than you and I will be forgotten, but he will be forgotten. We're all going to be forgotten. And even more depressingly, if I really do believe that the universe is 14 billion years old, the short amount of time that biologic life has been alive on this planet is nothing compared to the oceans of dead time that precede us and the oceans of dead time that will follow us. You have to accept, you have to embrace the truth that you have no ultimate meaning or purpose for life. And you can look at Tolstoy and you can be like, well, he's just a gloomy, depressed guy. You know, I shouldn't listen to him. I could do what I want. Well, you could say that if you want, but you're not refuting his logic by saying that. You're not showing that he's wrong. You see, as an atheist, I had to come to this conclusion, and it bothered me. It bothered me quite a bit. But it gets worse. Well, you say, well, what's so bad about that? You know, why is it so bad? What if that's the way the universe really is? Maybe it really just is pitiless indifference, and we just have to suck it up and live that way. Well, if you remember, I quoted Albert Camus a little earlier, and it was from a book called The Myth of Sisyphus. And in the book, The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus is actually commenting on a true Greek myth. Well, not true, because it's a myth. But it's an actual Greek myth about a guy named Sisyphus who was kind of a scumbag and he did a lot of mean things. But the thing that really got to the gods was he was trading secrets from the gods to mortals. And so the gods in Greek mythology were pretty hardcore. And so they sent him to hell, and this was his punishment. They said, every day, you're going to roll a boulder up this very big hill. And no matter what you do, when you come 10 feet from the top, that boulder's going to roll down. No matter what you do. And he had to do that endlessly for the rest of his eternity, I guess. And this is the point of the myth. The point of the myth is that hell is having to repeat the same task over and over again from which nothing of meaning ever comes. That's what hell is. And what Camus is saying in his book is he's saying, if you embrace the fact that there is no God you could really know or no God, you have to say we are all Sisyphus. We are all doomed to spend every day repeating meaningless tasks from which nothing of value ever comes. We are all Sisyphus. That's his point. So that's pretty bad, but it gets worse. Tolstoy, he goes on and he says this. He says, he's talking about why he was depressed. And he's saying, I didn't understand why I was depressed. He says, every single purpose and meaning of my life that I was fulfilling, he says, I was doing it. I wanted to be an author, and I was an author. I wanted to be a father, and I was a father. I wanted to be a husband, and I was a husband. I wanted to be smart, and I was smart. I wanted to be famous, and I was famous. And yet, I had this crushing amount of depression inside of me that I couldn't get rid of. And this is what he says. He says, I could give no reasonable meaning for any action of my life. And I was surprised that I had not understood this from the very beginning. My state of mind was as if some wicked and stupid prank was being played upon me by someone. One can live only so long as one is intoxicated, drunk with life. But when one grows sober, one cannot fail to see that it is all a stupid cheat. What is truest about it is that there is nothing even funny or silly in it. It is cruel and stupid, pure and simple. Now here's what he's saying. He's saying, I was able to live and function in my life just so long as I was intoxicated or drunk with certain pleasures or certain desires or certain hopes. But the second I sobered up, the truth crushed me. Now, for me, I didn't have a problem with that because I struggled with depression. And people who struggle with depression, I didn't understand it was depression at that time when I was 13 years old, but you could ask my parents, they're actually here tonight, that I was kind of a bummed out kid when I was 13 years old. I was kind of a weird kid. And that's a weird sound. But anyway, I was kind of a bummed out kid. And I didn't really understand how no one else could realize these truths that I was realizing. And this is what I started to understand as a teenager. People with depression have a rare ability to focus on truths that other people would rather ignore. In fact, in one of my favorite animated films, Inside Out, there's one bummed out character named Sadness. And then one time she falls on her face and she starts crying. And Joy's trying to get her on her feet. And she says, but I like crying. It allows me to slow down and to obsess about the weight of all life's problems. And, you know, being a depressed guy, I listen to that. I'm like, yeah, I get that. You know, I could just obsess about life's problems and obsess about how meaningless life is. And I could feel good about that in my own weird, messed up way. But most people aren't like me. Most people would rather ignore this truth. And so they ignore it. They don't focus on it. But here's what Tolstoy is saying. He's saying you're in a collision course with yourself. You might as well set your clock because there's coming a time when you're going to sober up. And when you sober up, this truth will crush you the same way it crushed me. Could be today, could be tomorrow, could be in 50 years, but eventually it is going to sober you up. So what is it that actually sobers you up? What happens? Well, here's my second point, and it's called the problem of hope. What keeps us drunk on life is hope. It's desire that things are going to get better or that we're reaching for something grander or greater than ourselves. And this hope is what keeps us drunk. It keeps us blind to the truth of what reality actually is. And the two things that are going to sober you up when it comes to hope is A, you're going to lose all hope, or B, you will achieve your hope, both of which will crush you. So the first one is pretty obvious, right? It's, I have a hope, I have a desire, whether it's I want to live for my family or I want to live for my career or I want to live for humanity. And whatever my hope is, it inevitably gets crushed, it gets destroyed. Maybe I have no greater dreams than to be a father, and then my little kid is killed. Or maybe I have no greater dreams than to have a great career and I get fired. Or maybe I have great dreams of going to school and becoming a doctor, and all of a sudden my dreams collapse and I can't pass the test. Or maybe I have dreams of becoming an athlete and I throw out my knee. Something like that will crush that, crushes your hopes, will sober you up, and you'll start asking these questions. Why am I doing anything? Now, the second one's a little more subtle, and that's achieving our goals. Now, the reason why so many people don't realize what a danger this is because so many of us don't actually ever achieve our goals. We never achieve what we set out to do. This is from a woman named Cynthia Heimel. She was an author for a magazine in New York, and she actually spent a lot of her young life in Southern California, where she met a lot of actors and actresses. And she's kind of snarky, and she's kind of a little bit sarcastic, but I like it, and you'll see what I mean when I read this. She says this, "I pity them, actors. No, I do. The minute a person becomes a celebrity is the same minute he or she becomes a monster. Sylvester Stallone, Bruce Willis, and Barbara Streisand were once perfectly pleasant human beings with whom you might want to have lunch with on a slow Tuesday afternoon. But now they have become supreme beings and their wrath is awful. It's not what they had in mind. See, when God wants to play a really rotten practical joke on you, he grants you your deepest wish and then giggles merrily when you suddenly want to kill yourself. Sylvester Stallone, Bruce Willis, and Barbara fervently, more than any of us, wanted fame. They worked, they pushed, they stepped on the other guy's face in the desperate need. The night each of them became famous, though, they wanted to shriek with relief. Finally, now they were adored, invincible, magic. However, the morning after each of them became famous, they wanted to take an overdose of barbiturates. All their fantasies had been realized, yet the reality was still the same. If they were miserable before, they were twice as miserable now. Because the giant thing they were striving for, that fame thing that was going to make everything okay, that was going to make their lives bearable for once, that was going to provide them with fulfillment and happiness, had happened, and nothing had changed. They were still them. The disillusionment turned them howling and insufferable." See what she's saying? These people, they wanted more than anything. They wanted fame. They wanted this grand thing. And they strove and they got it. And when they got it, they realized it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. See, so as long as that carrot is dangling on the end of the stick of whatever your hope is in your life, you can live in disillusionment. But if you ever grab it or it ever falls, you will sober up. And eventually, one or the other is going to happen. Eventually, one or the other is going to happen, no matter what you do. And beyond that, if you say, okay, well, what if I'm happy just living in my own illusions and just believing that my hope is good and I just want to live for tomorrow, and what's wrong with that? What if I never get to this place of sobering up? Well, there's consequences of that too. This is a quote from someone who's not too popular anymore, but her name is Madonna. And back when she was popular, she gave an interview to a magazine. And in the interview, this is what the magazine is actually commenting on her, and then she's going to respond. It says, "It's that discipline matched with talent, drive, and ambition that propels her. I have an iron will," she says, eating her Caesar salad, "and all of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I'm always struggling with that fear. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being. But then, after I get past that, I get to another stage and think I'm mediocre and uninteresting again. And I find a way to get myself out of that again and again. My drive in life is from this horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me. Because even though I've become somebody, I always feel the need to prove that I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will. So what's the consequence of never achieving the goal that you set for yourself? You're always going to feel like a failure. I mean, if you think about it, if you set a goal for yourself and you never achieve it, what would you call that? That's someone who is perpetually, eternally a failure. And this is how she feels. All the time, what's her goal? To not be mediocre. But how do you even measure that? The more she gets, the more like a failure she feels. She always feels like a failure. And there's an even worse consequence that can happen. David Foster Wallace, who was an author back in the day, he once gave a commencement speech at a college. And this speech made a lot of people angry because, again, he's an atheist, and he's saying something that cut to the heart of everyone who actually heard it. And this is what he said. He says, "Here's the thing that's weird but true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice that we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it JC or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess, or the Four Noble Truths, or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, you will end up feeling weak and afraid. You will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious. They are the default setting that we all follow." See what he's saying? He's saying that if I live for my own purpose and my own meaning, the more I achieve of my purpose, the more I'm going to need of it to feel the same amount of satisfaction. And it's going to turn on me. The more I feed it, the more it feeds on me. Right? If I want to be a great parent, no matter what happens inside of my kid's life, I will always assume that it's my fault and I will feel like a failure. If I worship my career, if I worship being seen as wealthy, I'm always going to feel like I'm not as good as the other guy, and I'm never going to feel like I have enough or that I've achieved enough. See, the more you feed it, the more it's going to feed on you, and it has even more lasting consequences. Both Cynthia Heimel and Madonna and David Foster Wallace are touching on something that they themselves don't fully understand. And what they're touching on is this. They understand that there is something out there that should satisfy us, but we don't know what it is. So anyway, he's saying, David Foster Wallace and Madonna and them, they're saying that there's something out there that they want, but they're not getting from whatever they're living for. And David Foster Wallace, at the end of his speech, he actually touches on what this thing is, although he never clearly says what it is. Listen to this. He says, "Of course, there are all different kinds of freedom, and the kind that is most precious you will not hear much talk about in the great outside world of wanting and achieving. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able to truly care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over again in a myriad of petty, unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. That is being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sensation of having had and lost some infinite thing." So you guys catch, what is the thing that he knows he needs but can't get? It's love. It's being able to genuinely care about someone selflessly. But here's the thing, if you construct your own meaning of existence, then who are you living for? Yourself. And if all you do is live to feed yourself, how could you possibly ever learn to truly care genuinely about another's well-being? See, even the good things that you do will be out of a need to justify yourself. Even if you give tithes and offerings, even if you go out and you do charity work, even if you go to other countries and you evangelize, no matter what you do, all of it will be to satisfy some gnawing sensation that you're a fraud. And it will eat you up. Now, I don't know too much about David Foster Wallace to say this definitively, but here's what I do know. He committed suicide a couple months after saying this. And there's a pretty good chance that there was something in his life that was eating him alive. And no matter how much he understood it, he couldn't stop. So there are definitely consequences to living this kind of way. Now let's talk about the third problem. And this is a problem that's generally used as an argument against Christianity. And it's the problem of pain and suffering. But my point tonight is going to be that pain and suffering is actually an argument for God. Now, I don't want to downplay pain and suffering at all. I understand that this is probably one of the deepest, most emotional reasons why someone would leave God. It's difficult to justify the pain and suffering that we go through with a just and loving God. And sometimes it is easier just to stop believing in the face of this type of suffering. But if you really think about it, not believing in God is far more damaging than believing in God in the midst of pain and suffering, no matter what you believe about him. And this is what I mean. If you believe that God is not personal, that he is a force, or he's non-existent, you have to accept the fact that every single amount of pain and suffering that you will go through is meaningless. It's useless. And that is a thought that is absolutely rejected by our subconscious. Look at any movie or TV show or book that you'll read about humanity and perseverance. And what you'll see is you'll see a person going through intense amount of suffering and overcoming it at the end. And we're all filled with joy. We're like, yes, that's true. And what it does for you is in every amount of suffering that you go through in your life, you look back and you say, no, it did have meaning. It did have purpose. If you adopt this mentality, you have to agree that everything you go through is absolutely worthless. That we all suffer and we all die and get over it. This is what Jim Morrison said, who is the lead singer of The Doors. He said, people fear death even more than pain. It's strange that they fear death. Life hurts a lot more than death. At the point of death, the pain is finally over. Yes, I guess it is a friend. Jim Morrison also committed suicide not too long after saying that. So you see, if I adopt this mentality, I have to agree with that every amount of pain and suffering I go through is useless, and I can't do that. I mean, how could you possibly think that way? That we all just live little meaningless lives in which we suffer untold, unspeakable amounts of pain, and then you die and it's over. No one could actually live that way. No one could actually believe that and function in a meaningful existence. Voltaire, who was a philosopher back in the day, he wrote a poem called All Is Well, kind of tongue-in-cheek there because it was one of the most depressing poems I've ever read. And All Is Well is about pain and suffering. And Voltaire, if you've never read his writings, he likes to poke holes in everyone's ideology. So even though he was an atheist, he also likes to poke holes in atheism, which is very interesting for him to do. And in his poem, he spends the majority of it accusing the theist view of pain and suffering, but then at certain parts of it, he subtly condemns atheist views of pain and suffering. And this is what he says. He says, what is the verdict of the vastest mind? Silence. The book of fate is closed to us. Man is a stranger to his own research. He knows not whence he comes, nor whither goes. Tormented atoms in a bed of mud, devoured by death, a mockery of fate. Isn't that just fantastic writing? That's what he's saying. He's saying, that's all you are. You're just a tormented bunch of atoms in a pool of mud. That's it. And everything you go through, just it sucks, and then you're dead. And you just got to get over that. Isn't that cheery? And see, this is where he really gets to the point, though, of why that is inconsistent. This is what he says. Now listen, this is very subtle, but it's very insightful. He says this, I am a puny part of the great whole. Yes, but all animals are condemned to live. All sentient beings born by the same stern law suffer like me, and like me also die. You see what he's saying? He's saying, yeah, all my pain and suffering is meaningless. Yes, my death is absolutely worthless. However, every single animal on this planet is the same way. And yet, I'm the only one who's bothered by it. Why am I so bothered by it? Why is my dog not pacing up and down the stairs and worrying about this? Why aren't chimpanzees or dolphins freaking out and writing poetry about how much life is meaningless? I mean, why is me, a human being, the most advanced and informed of all the species, freaking out about something that doesn't matter in the end? I mean, shouldn't we know better? And to put it another way, why on earth would I be built with this idea that things are unjust and unfair when that's the way that things have always been? See, as an atheist, I couldn't reconcile this. See, I believed in my head that yes, all pain and suffering is useless, and yes, we all die and blah, blah, blah. I get that. But deep down, I couldn't help but be bothered by it. And I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't silence that truth. C.S. Lewis was much like me. In his book, Mere Christianity, he says this: "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just or unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of what a straight line is. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? If the whole show is bad and senseless from A to Z, so to speak, why did I, who is supposed to be a part of that very show, find myself in such violent reaction against it? A man feels wet when he falls into water because man is not a water animal. Fish would not feel wet in water. Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing more but a private idea of my own, but if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world really was unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies." See what he's saying? If I use pain and suffering as an argument against God, I have to come to the conclusion that why am I so bothered by pain and suffering? What do you mean God's not just? What do you mean it's not fair that you lost your family? What do you mean by that? Isn't that the way everyone lives their lives? Either you're going to die young, or you will have to watch everyone you love die slowly as you pass away. That's the way reality works. Why are you so bothered by it? See, and he couldn't shake that feeling that there was something wrong with the world. And that drove him not away from God, but to God. Now, this is the final thing I'm going to go over. If you reject God, you have to come to the conclusion that your feelings are mere illusions. And I'm not talking about emotional feelings. This is what I'm talking about, two specific ones that I'll give you. Your feelings of morality and your feelings of beauty are illusions. They're not real. Now, let's go over feelings of morality first. We all have these feelings of moral, I call it moral applause, where you feel like someone did something that's worthy of applauding, that you're like, man, that was great, and you feel amazing. You know, there was a couple movies that came out this year, Deepwater Horizon and Patriot's Day, I think by the same director. And both these movies show the indomitability of the human spirit and how, you know, bad stuff happens, but there are good people out there, and everyone who watches it gets filled with this good feeling, like, man, you know, like maybe humanity's pretty good after all, you know? And we feel good about that. Now, if I adopt this doctrine of meaninglessness, though, I have to think that that feeling of moral applause is nothing more than an illusion that helped us survive better than other species. Let me put it in context for you. This is true. Mother hens will give their lives for their young, without exception. Right? So even if there's a fire in the farmhouse, a mother hen will actually go so far as to cover her little young ones in her wings and die over them so that they can live. Right? Now, if I was in school and I was talking to one of my professors, I was like, did you know that there was a mother hen that gave her life for her young yesterday? Isn't that amazing? Isn't that incredible? Doesn't it give you hope for humanity and the world in general? He'd be like, Peter, you got to understand. That chicken was just predisposed to protect its own genetic material. There was nothing moral about that or good about that. That's just what she knows she has to do in order to survive. And I could accept that for a chicken, but there's something in me that rejects that notion when it comes to humanity. You see, if I heard a story about a mother giving her life to protect her children, knowing that she's going to die and doing it anyway, I would be filled with emotions of that was an awesome thing that she did. What a morally amazing thing that she did. We should write a story about her. We should do a book about her. That is incredible that someone would be willing to do that for their offspring. No atheist would poke a hole in that and be like, well, actually, you know, Humanity is just developed to do that. So actually, she didn't have a choice. You know, that's just kind of like what we're predisposed to do, you know, to protect our own offspring. You know, so there's really nothing special about that. No one would say that. Or how about moral condemnation, or as Christians put it, indignation, right? Righteous anger over wrong things that have happened. This is also true. Don't believe the Lion King. But actually, lions, when they go into a neighboring territory and they take it over, and there's a pride there that they don't like, they will go and they will kill every member of that pride and even eat their young. Now, once again, if I heard that and I went to my professor and said, isn't that horrible that lions do this? They eat the young of neighboring tribe. I mean, that's horrible. I mean, what a barbaric thing to do. We should execute all lions because of what wicked creatures they are. Or to put it another way, you know, when I was a little kid, I had this little stupid dog named Jojo. And this little dog named Jojo used to hump everything in sight. And we had this other dog named Rose, and Jojo would always try to hump Rose whenever she was in heat. I would never look at the heat, whether she wanted or not. And I would never look at him and be like, what a sick rapist, you know? We need to put that guy down. You know, what a horrible animal to do this. I can't live in a world where this kind of thing is tolerated. You know, I can't abide by this. No one would ever say that. But you see, if you're going to pop the bubble for animals, you got to pop the bubble for humans too. What happens when you hear the next story about how ISIS invades a neighboring town, kills all the men, rapes all the women? Are you going to say the same thing? That, oh, no, you don't understand. You see, they're just morally inclined to do that. There's nothing wrong with it. We just have our morality and they have their morality and who knows who's right. No one would say that. However, that is what you're forced to believe. All your feelings of morality are illusions created to help you better propagate the species. They're not real. G.K. Chesterton put it this way. The new rebel is a skeptic and will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty. Therefore, he can never really be a revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything really gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. The modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution that he denounces, but the doctrine by which he denounces it. As a politician, he will cry out that war is a waste of life. Then as a philosopher, that all life is a waste of time. A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, and then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant should have killed himself. The man of this school goes first to a political meeting where he complains that savages are treated as if they were beasts. Then he takes his hat, an umbrella, and goes to a scientific meeting where he proves that we are beasts. In short, the modern revolutionist, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaged in undermining his own mind. Right? That is a very awesome quote. I love it so much. It's a way of saying you're in a collision course with yourself. You can't denounce anything if you think everything's meaningless. You can't take any moral stand if you believe it's all subjective. You can't live that way. The last thing I'm going to mention very quickly is feelings of beauty and love. You have to believe that feelings of beauty and love are nothing more than illusions that help us better survive as a species. This is what C.S. Lewis says in his book, Present Concerns. He says, you can't, except in the lowest animal sense, be in love with a girl if you know and keep on knowing that all the beauties of both her person and her character are just a momentary and accidental pattern produced by the collision of atoms, and that your own response to them is only sort of a psychic phosphorescence arising from behavior of your own genes. You can't go on getting any very serious pleasure from music if you know and remember that its air of significance is pure illusion. That you like it is only because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to like it. You may still, in the lowest sense, have a good time, but just so far as it becomes a very good time, just in so far as it ever threatens to push you on from cold sensuality into real warmth and enthusiasm and joy, so afar you will be forced to feel the hopeless disharmony between your own emotions and the universe in which you really live. This is what Chesterton and Lewis are saying. They're saying the only way to enjoy love, beauty, poetry, music is to not think. The only way to have moral principles is to not think. The only way to enjoy whatever meaning you've surrounded your life with is to not think. And here's the ultimate question. If you start with a premise, life is meaningless and there is no God you could truly know, and every single conclusion you come to goes against everything you fundamentally believe in, when will you start to agree that your premise is flawed? See, if every conclusion is wrong, that means that the premise must be wrong. But you see, we don't do that. We instead continue to delude ourselves and believe that there must be something that we're not understanding yet. Now, if you're in this room and you're anything like I was when I was 13, you've noticed a problem in everything I'm saying. See, if you remember, I said I was a Christian and I became an atheist. So that means as an atheist, I understood all this. I just didn't care enough to turn. And this is why. I would look at someone speaking this way and I would say, you know what? Yeah, I agree with you. You've demolished any sensibilities about the way I live. Good for you. However, you fail to realize that the Christian perspective isn't any better. It's not any better. So what you're telling me is that I have to live, my meaning and purpose in life is to live for God? Is that what you're telling me? That God sits up in heaven and he tells me you must do this, this, and this, and don't do that, that, and that? And that's the kind of relationship you want me to have? And no matter what type of pain and suffering he introduces into my life, I have to just accept that it's part of a greater plan that I'll never understand? Is that what you're telling me? If that's what you're telling me, then you are telling me, you are encouraging me to get inside of one of the most abusive and dehumanizing relationships that I've ever been in my entire life for eternity. You see, that is absolutely repulsive to our sensibilities to believe that way. And this leads me to my final point. The gospel is far more liberating than you could ever know. See, the reason why I thought that way as a kid is because, to put it simply, even though I grew up in church, I didn't understand the gospel. I really didn't. I understood it in my head. Jesus died for sins, I get that. But I didn't really understand its implications. I didn't think it through. I didn't understand what it meant. See, and yes, if God just sits up in heaven and he says, you must live up to my standards, you must live up to my conditions, and then I'll have a relationship with you, that is dehumanizing. That is horrible if God does that. It would be just like if you were in a human relationship where the person that you're with says, you must do this, this, and this, or else I'm going to dump you. You'd always be walking on eggshells. You would always be afraid that they were going to leave you at a moment's notice. You wouldn't feel liberated. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you have been in a romantic relationship with someone where you sacrificed for them and you gave yourselves to them, and they ended up taking your sacrifice and your love and they trampled on it. And there's nothing on this planet that is worse than that. And having a relationship with God like that is absolutely terrible. But not this God. In John 1, verse 18, John says that the Son has come to make God known to man. This is what John is saying. He's saying that in all of our societies and all of our trying to figure out exactly what God is like, Jesus has come and he has said, this is what God is really like. And he is not like that. How do I know? Well, like I said, if I sacrifice for someone and they don't sacrifice back, it's dehumanizing. But in order to have any meaningful, loving relationship, you do have to sacrifice your individuality and your freedom. And if both people do it simultaneously, it's unbelievably freeing to be in a relationship like that, where both people are willing to sacrifice and compromise and change and alter for the other. This is the kind of God we believe in. We don't believe in a God who sat up in heaven and says, you change for me. We believe in a God who came down from heaven and changed for us, who gave everything to be with us. Yeah. See, Jesus says, I stand at the door and I knock. See, do you see the difference? He doesn't say, I sit in my castle and you knock, and maybe I'll decide to open the door if you do enough good deeds. He says, man, I come to your house and I knock and I wait for you to open. He sits in the vulnerable position. He's already sacrificed for you. He's already let you know that he wants a relationship with you. And this is another amazing thing that John 1 teaches us. See, John in John 1, verse 1, he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory of that of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Now that word for word, that's kind of a weird sentence, but anyway, the word for word is in Greek, it's the Greek word logos, from which we get our word logic. And actually, Greek philosophers, they used to debate about the logos, because what the logos was to them was it was the reason for existence. They said, man, if we could figure out the logos, the telos, the reason for existence, we would reach the potential of our joy and satisfaction and pleasure. And they debated about what this reason for existence could possibly be. and they could never figure it out. And here John comes and he says, there is a reason for existence. And it's not a list of rules. It's not a path to walk down. It's not a life to live. It's not something to follow. It is a person. The reason for existence is to know a person and to fall in love with them. And this person loved you so much that they became like you, frail, fragile, mortal, and died for you. That is the message of the gospel, and it's unbelievably liberating when we understand it. You'll no longer be trapped under the same principles that I was, where I always felt like I wasn't measuring up enough and I wasn't doing enough. But I understand it's my relationship with God is not based on what I do for him, but it's based on what he did to be in a relationship with me. See, it changed my perspective when I started to realize this truth. In the book, The Life of Pi, I have no idea if this is in the movie because I haven't seen it, but in the book, The Life of Pi, he is a Hindu and he's talking to a Christian about the gospel. And this is what he says. He says, that a god should put up with adversity, I could understand that. The gods of Hinduism face their shares of thieves, bullies, kidnappers, and usurpers. Adversity, yes. Reversals of fortune, yes. Treachery, yes. But humiliation? Death? I couldn't imagine Lord Krishna consenting to being stripped naked, whipped, mocked, dragged through the streets, and to top it off, crucified? And at the hands of mere humans to boot? And once a dead god, always a dead god, even when he's resurrected, the son must have the taste of death forever in his mouth. The Trinity must be tainted by it. There must be a certain stench at the right hand of God the Father. The horror must be real. Why would God wish that upon himself? Why not leave death to mortals? Why make dirty that which is beautiful? Why spoil that which is perfect? Love. That was Father Martin's answer to me. Isn't that amazing? Like, it's just so incredible to think about that. That God would subject himself to that he would become like us, he would die like we die for us. It's unbelievably liberating to believe like that. That is why Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, it is the love of Christ that compels me, not the fear, not the doubt. And the final problem that we have is the problem of pain. There's much I could go into on this, but this is what I'll say. The cross answers the problem of pain. There was an article written years back called Why Did Jesus Have to Die? It was in Time magazine. And there was one pastor who's, a female minister who was interviewed. And she described how when she was a young girl, she had to watch as her mom's boyfriend beat her to death. And she said she was always haunted by the blood-stained mattress in her mom's room and the bloody handprint that she saw on the wall. And she could never get over that. But she said, when I read the story of the gospel, I finally understood I serve and I love a God who knows what it's like to be beaten to death by someone that should have loved him. You see, the Bible does affirm that there is a reason for why you're going through whatever you're going through. And it does affirm that every millisecond of your suffering is for an infinite purpose. However, it doesn't just give us cold, distant answers. Jesus says, you know how I answer the problem of pain? I become pain. I die the most horrible, gruesome, brutal death for you. And if the Father subjected his own son to that kind of horror, and he said, this is for the glory and the salvation of all mankind, he can transform any suffering you and I go through into glory. And the reason why I trust him in that is because he didn't keep himself out of pain, but he endured it for me. He could have. God could have avoided pain forever, but he didn't. So if you're in this room and you're like me and you had walked away from God, or if you've never given your life to God, Jesus says in Matthew 11, verse 28, he says, come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. If you're in this room and you are weary of trying to construct your own meaning in life, of trying to live for your own purposes, trying to live for things that are ultimately dying, Jesus says, come unto me and find rest, for he has already borne the burden for our suffering. And if you know him, if you love him, if you get to understand him better, you understand the unbelievable freedom that is in him. And hopefully, after listening to this, you will be able to finally go and objectively look at the truth. Because like I said, I haven't proven anything tonight. But if Jesus really was a real person, and if he was who he said he was, and he did what he said he did, then there is no greater truth than you could ever learn than that. So my encouragement to you is to really look into it for yourself. Did it really happen? Now I'm going to pray, and then the worship team is going to come up and do one final song. But I'll be up here tonight after this is over, and if you have any questions about anything I went over, or you just want prayer or anything, just let me know, and I'll be happy to pray with you or talk with you. Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word and so much for your son. God, how you did give everything to be with us, Lord, how you did suffer and die on our behalf. And I pray that the gospel would sink into the deepest recesses of our heart, that we would stop trying to live up to your standards and start believing what you did for us, that by faith we are saved, not by works. God, and that from that love we would live lives of sacrifice towards you, Lord, not out of fear, but out of love. In your name, amen.